Trimester of classes. I want to take just a moment to say something about that, to encourage you, if you haven't been a part of our class program, to come and start being a part of that. And begin with the new classes. We begin with the book of Hebrews next Lord's Day morning, and then 1 Samuel on the following Wednesday night. I mention that because we want to encourage our teachers, as you begin teaching this time, to use our resource materials. We've spent a lot of money on a new resource room and putting new materials in there, and encourage you to use those resources. I think the teachers of the younger classes are using those, but not sure that the teachers of the upper classes are using that as much. But there's good materials in there for you to use, and it's there for you not only as a teacher, but as a student. As you'll be studying, if you need some help from those materials, go into our resource room down the hall and make use of that. If you want to know about some of the materials in there, talk to Melissa Johnson. She's organized that and keeps it all organized. If there's something that you think it needs to be in there that's not, talk to Larry Hornaday. He's overseeing that, and he'll help you out with that. Also, our electronic resource room. Teachers make use of that. We're on a temporary basis with that, and if it's used, we'll renew that. And if it's not used, we'll cancel that. And so make use of that. It's free material in the resource, electronic resource room, and students as well make use of that. With that in mind, we begin the book of Hebrews next Lord's Day morning in Bible classes, and we start with chapter 1, and there's not time for a sufficient introduction. I want to talk about the book of Hebrews for a little while this morning and give some introductory information to the book of Hebrews. And that may sound like something that you think you don't need. And that's because sometimes to thoroughly study the book of Hebrews is an intimidating task to some people. And it is something that is intimidating from the vantage point, like studying the book of Revelation, which we will do a year from now. But the depth of the book causes some people to wonder, do I really need such a book as the book of Hebrews? I would enjoy studying the Gospels and the book of Acts, and maybe a book like 1 Corinthians or Ephesians. Those are nice James. Those are nice simple books that are easy to understand. But the depth of the book causes some people to wonder, do I really need this book at all? But you probably need the book of Hebrews more than you realize you need the book. And it is a very practical book. You need this book. And that's why you need to be a part of our Bible class program, and you need this introductory material, is because you need this book. If you need encouragement, I hear that a great deal. I need encouragement. I want to hear something encouraging to me. Well, if that's what you need this book of Hebrews. I don't know of another book that encourages like the book of Hebrews. If you have even a smattering knowledge of the book of Hebrews, you understand that that's the import of the book. And more about that from chapter 13 in a moment. If you need Christ, who is better than prophets and angels and Moses and Aaron, and has a better covenant and a better priesthood and a better tabernacle, if you need all of that, then you need the book of Hebrews, because that's what it's about. If you need to be reminded not to give up, do you ever get discouraged to the point you're almost ready just to give up, but you know you don't need to, and you need to be reminded, I don't need to give up, but I need to keep pressing on to the end and hold out fast to the end of time, then you need the book of Hebrews. There's not another book like this one that so makes that point. If you need to hear about the dangers of falling back, if you say, I need to be reminded constantly the danger of drifting back so that I keep pressing forward and I don't give up, then you, my friend, need the book of Hebrews. It is the most needed book. And though it is a book that is in depth, the message is quite simple. And here is the design of the book. It's designed to exhort. Chapter 13 of the book of Hebrews. Let's jump ahead to the end of the book. And I hope you have a pen or a pencil, and we'll make some notations in the margin of your Bible about the introductory thoughts, because this is important to interpretation of the book, and there is varied interpretation, as we shall see. But chapter 13, if you will, and in verse 32, he said, I appeal to you, brethren, bear with a word of exhortation. That's what he called this book. He calls it a word of exhortation. The message is simple. There's some difficulty, and we'll talk about what the difficulties are in the book, and it is a book that has some depth, but the message is quite simple and it's quite clear. It was written to people who were discouraged. You say, well, I go to church and I'm discouraged and I want to hear something encouraging for me. And I don't, this book of Hebrews just gets over my head and I don't understand. Do you realize it was written to people who were in that very circumstance? They were discouraged, probably more so than any of us are. And they needed this letter. And it was a word of exhortation. Let's start with this. Let's talk about the title to the book. Titles that are in our English text where you open your Bible and it says the Gospel of Matthew, the Gospel of Mark, the Gospel of Luke, and the Gospel of John, and the Acts of the Apostles. Those titles that are given to the books were not a part of inspiration. So we need to talk about the title. The English text says the Epistle to the Hebrews. And there's a reason for that. The early manuscripts, Aleph, A and B, bear the title to Hebrews, is what it said. And I will bear with some quotations, but these will be important. Some of our teachers will want to know some of these references, and I give the references where they are found. This is Robert Milligan, one of the best commentaries on the book of Hebrews. But he said, "But this much is certain, that the title was prefixed to our epistle at a very early date, and most likely before the close of the apostolic age. And that as the book is canonized, someone deemed that we label this book to the Hebrews, or to Hebrews, was the title that was given to the book." Dan King suggests later that it was enlarged to the Epistle to the Hebrews. Let's talk about the name Hebrew. The first occurrence of this term Hebrew is found in Genesis 14 and in verse 13, where the Canaanites seem to pin that on Abraham because he was considered a foreigner. And you can look at the context of that, and that's the first occurrence it was ever used in the Bible. Its origin emphasized a foreigner, Milligan suggests, as the context shows in Genesis chapter 14 and in verse 13. And Jews throughout the Old Testament, denoting all of the descendants of Jacob, were referred to as Hebrews, but they often referred to themselves as Hebrews in the context of talking to someone who was a foreigner. They were foreigners to them. "I am a Hebrew, one who fears God." That's what Jonah said in Jonah 1 and in verse 9. He used that very term. But in the New Testament, it focused more on the language, and that is those Jews who spoke Hebrew. So, it is a book that is written to those who are of a Jewish audience, and we'll say more about the audience in a moment. But the idea of the title of the book is you open it up, and that's an important, anytime you read a book and study, you open up and you look at the title. What does this title suggest to me? And it was to Hebrews, to the Hebrews, the Epistle to the Hebrews. And we know something about who they were. Let's talk about the author of the book. That is the biggest, perhaps the biggest question of all. If you read, as I have been reading for several weeks, introductory information about the book of Hebrews, most of what you read will delve into who the author was. And that is perhaps the biggest question, since the author name is not found on the book. Paul often in his writings would say, "Paul, an apostle of Jesus Christ, and a prisoner of the Lord too," and that is to the church which is at, and he begins his letter. And he identifies himself, but the author here does not identify himself. And his name is not there. Origen, who was one of the church fathers, so-called, said who the author of this epistle is, God only knows. And he may be right about that. But it does seem that, or it doesn't seem that it was completely anonymous to the recipients of the book. Let's go to chapter 13 again, and we get a lot of hints from the 13th chapter. As he closes this letter, the author says, "I urge you especially, do this, that I may be restored to you sooner." Well, if they don't know who he is, what does that mean to them to suggest that I want to come to you, I want to visit with you, and I want to come again unto you, and to make a reference to Timothy, and I may come with Timothy when he comes a little later, verse 23. It was not completely anonymous to those who were the recipients of the book. As chapter 13 so gives evidence. Here are some of the suggested authors. We won't take the time, as many do, in telling all the details about this, but some think that Paul was. Some suggest Clement of Rome. Some say Apollos. Some say Aquila. Barnabas and Luke and Mark, that is John Mark, Silas, and Philip the Evangelist have all been suggested. One that's not in there, some have suggested Priscilla may have been the author of the book. And there are various reasons why some suggest, and those are kind of minor argumentation for the reason saying that those were some of the people that wrote the book. But the traditional view and the predominant view is that it was the Apostle Paul who wrote the book. And some are very adamant that he did not write the book, and others are very adamant that he did write the book. And let's talk about evidence. I think probably it was Paul. And you say, what's the significance of even knowing that? Well, that has a little bit to do with some of the interpretation of some of the verses. Not a great impact, but it does have some significance to that. So who wrote the book? Well, let's talk about some of the evidence that it was Paul, the apostle, who perhaps was the author. One of the evidence, and one of the strong evidences, is that early writers, and we put in quotations church fathers, these are people who lived just beyond the days of the apostles and the first, second, and third centuries. that they attributed the book to Paul, and they said it was Paul's book. Clement of Alexandria, who was writing about 187 A.D., was said that indeed that it was. Origen said the same thing. Pantaenus said the same thing. Eusebius said the same thing. And he quoted, I believe it was Eusebius who quoted from Pantaenus, who said that it was he was one of the first of the church fathers to so attribute it to Paul and say that indeed Paul had written the book. Tertullian said much the same thing, and so did Jerome say the same thing. Well, that's pretty strong evidence when those who were contemporary with the apostles and lived shortly after the apostles, and some of them had been disciples of people who were close to the apostles, who said that indeed it was the apostle Paul who wrote the book. Brother King, who was indeed a scholar himself, wrote in his commentary on the book of Hebrews, said that save the occasional voice against it, Hebrews was generally taken as Pauline until the Reformation, when Erasmus vigorously fought for a change in this opinion. So up to the time of the Reformation, it was generally held by most that indeed Paul was the author thereof. But let's give another evidence of that. The fact that it is anonymous would argue for Paul. Now, Paul did identify himself in other letters, but what does the fact that he's anonymous? Well, the author had some valid reason for withholding his name. As you would, if someone sent you a letter and they didn't put their name on it, there's a reason for that. And particularly if it was intended and it was not a matter of just forgetfulness and writing by inspiration, there certainly wasn't a matter he just forgot to put his name on it. There was a valid reason for that. The early writers, the church fathers again that I talked about, they alleged in their writings when they attributed it to Paul that they said he withheld his name lest the appearance of it kept some Jewish brethren from reading it because of the prejudice against Paul. Well, that again, pretty strong evidence that there is a reason why Paul would have left his name off of that. With a strong prejudice against Paul, was there prejudice against other apostles? There certainly were. But there seemed to be stronger prejudice against Paul, as is evidenced in 2 Corinthians, as is evidenced in Romans and in Galatians. Galatians 2 particularly, Acts 15. Other passages show that there was great prejudice against Paul. And that would seem to fit the circumstance and the situation under which the book of Hebrews seems to be written. Let's go back to chapter 13. We find so much in chapter 13. Whoever the author was a close associate of and close association with Timothy. So then he said, our brother Timothy has been set free, with whom I shall see you if he comes shortly. I'm going to come with him. So apparently the author is free at this point. We'll say more about that at this moment. If it is Paul, and I think it is, that he said, I'm going to come with Timothy. Well, there could have been other companions with Timothy. Barnabas has been one who's been suggested. But Paul was a close associate, and that would fit Paul. Well, there's another evidence we might suggest. The writer had been in chains, or was in chains, and I think verse 23 of chapter 13 suggests he'd just been, or at least is released, but he had been in chains. Turn to chapter 10 and in verse 34. We won't read all of these references, but chapter 10 and in verse 34, at some point he had been in chains, for he said, you had compassion on me in my chains. He'd been imprisoned. Well, Paul had been in Rome in prison on two different occasions, and we think this was written after the first imprisonment. But chapter 13, again, implies that he is set free now, but so that gives us something about the date of the book, and we'll say more about that in a moment. Let's give another evidence. Whoever the author was in Italy, seemingly, and there is a great deal of question among students about what is the meaning of verse 24, that they of Italy greet you. Some suggest that that means he's writing to the Italians. But he seems to be saying that those who are from Italy are with him, and that seems to imply that's where he is at the time of the writing. They of Italy send greetings. He seems to be arguing the fact that are saying that he was in Italy. Well, Paul was there for two imprisonments. That would fit Paul. So everything that we can see seems to fit with the Apostle Paul. There are terms and phrases that are similar to Paul. And some argue that the style is totally different from Paul. But there are phrases that are quite similar. And we won't have time to notice every detail. But you remember Paul talking, or the Hebrew writer at least, in chapter 5, talks about the milk and the meat and solid food. Well, that's the same kind of language used over in 1 Corinthians chapter 3. That's similar language to what Paul had used. We know Paul wrote 1 Corinthians. Well, there's another thing. For example, the quotation from Habakkuk 2 and verse 4, the just shall live by faith. You know, the only time that's quoted is in Hebrews 10 and verse 38, Galatians 3:11, and Romans 1:17. The other two are Paul's. Now, if this is Barnabas, or if this is Aquila, Priscilla, or Apollos, then that was the only other writer to ever quote Habakkuk 2, verse 4, but that harmonizes with Paul's quotation and his usage thereof. The use of Psalms 2 and in verse 7, quoted in Hebrews 1, is almost identical to the use made in Acts chapter 13 in a sermon that Paul preached. Paul talks about signs and wonders in chapter 2, or the writer does. Well, that's the same kind of language used in 1 Corinthians in the writing of Paul. The world consists by Christ. By Him all things consist. That's exactly the language used in chapter 2 and verse 10 that we find in Romans 11 and Colossians chapter 1. It's similar concepts and similar phrases that Paul would use. The descendants of Abraham, he talks about those in Hebrews chapter 2. We find that in Galatians 3 and in Romans 4. The word being compared to a sword, you remember Hebrews chapter 4? The word is sharper than any two-edged sword. The only other time we have that kind of reference in the New Testament is in Ephesians 6 that Paul wrote. The expression, if God permits, this we will do if God permits. Paul used that in 1 Corinthians chapter 16 and in verse 7. The Hebrew writer used that in chapter 6 and in verse 3. The confidence that we have through the blood of Christ. And this is just the beginning of a list. Chapter 10 and in verse 19. Well, that's similar language of Romans chapter 5 and Ephesians chapter 2. Well, that argues for the fact that perhaps Paul was the one that wrote the book. Let's go back to chapter 2 now. We've been in chapter 13. Let's go back to the beginning of the book in chapter 2 and in verse 3. Whoever the author was, he was not one of the 12. Because, he said, how shall we escape if we neglect so great salvation, which first began to be spoken by the Lord and was confirmed to us by those who heard Him? To my apostles. But He did include Himself in that. Confirmed to us by those who heard Him. Well, that doesn't exclude being it does not exclude an apostle in that, but it does exclude the original 12. And some have argued that the apostles were excluded in verse 3. Well, it doesn't exclude an apostle. It excludes the original 12. Paul was an apostle, but he wasn't one of the original 12. But whoever he was not one of the 12. So we have to eliminate those as the possible authors. Those reasons suggest that indeed Paul perhaps was the author. I can't be dogmatic about that, but I think that I can safely say Paul wrote the book of Hebrews. Now, let's talk about some of the arguments that Paul was not the author of that, and then we'll move to something that gets to the heart more of what the book is about and who the recipients were. Millikan says the strongest argument against Paul's authorship is the fact that the style is different from Paul. And if you just do a cursory reading of the text, that is not only of Hebrews, but of all the New Testament, you have to recognize that this is a little different than Romans. It's different than Galatians. And Galatians and Romans sound so much alike, you have to know those are the same man. Timothy and Titus are so similar, that's got to be the same man. Same language, etc. The style is different, they say. Well, that's not completely true. That is not completely true, because there are many ways in which the style is very similar to Romans. There are some differences, all right. But to say the style is different means there's a different author. Do you realize the style is different from Deuteronomy to Genesis, and no one questions it? Well, there are some modernists who do. But most of us don't question that Moses was the author of both of those. But the style is entirely different, isn't it? There's a different audience, a different circumstance, and that warrants a different style. That doesn't tell us that Paul was not the author. This, perhaps, I think, is a stronger argument than what Milligan thinks is the strongest argument. We go back to chapter 2 and in verse 13. The author here is dependent upon others. He said, the word was confirmed unto us. Includes himself in that. By those who heard him. So he was dependent upon learning the revelation. At least that's the argument that's made, that the author was dependent upon others to learn the revelation of God. But Paul said he was independent and he did not learn his revelation from others, but he learned it directly from Jesus Christ. So Paul is not the author, is the conclusion. Well, the author may be using that editorial us to identify himself with the Jewish brethren. King so argues that in his work. He does the same thing in chapter 6 and in verse 1. Let us go on unto perfection. That is, let us quit laying again the foundation of the first principles, but let us go on into perfection. And he was writing to people who were delinquent in their faith. Chapter 5 and in verse 12. He was not suggesting that he himself was delinquent, was he? But he includes himself in that when he says us. That's kind of that editorial us or that editorial we. Here's a third contention that's made that Paul is not the author and the last, and that is Paul was an apostle of the Gentiles, and this was a letter to the Hebrews, and this could not be one of his works because he was writing should have been writing to the Gentiles. Let's go to Acts chapter 9 and verse 15. The Apostle Paul's work was not confined to the Gentiles, meaning that he only preached to the Gentiles and never preached to Jews. Because in Acts chapter 9, right after his conversion, chapter 9 and verse 15 said that he was going to preach his name before the Gentiles, kings, and the children of Israel. That's Hebrews. He'll be preaching to Hebrews and to Jews. And by the way, in Acts chapter 13, he preached to Gentiles and to Jews in Acts chapter 13. So that doesn't tell us that Paul was not the author. Arthur Pink makes this argument, which I think is not a strong argument, but is an interesting argument nonetheless. He cites 2 Peter 3:15, where Peter said Paul wrote some things hard to be understood. And Pink says, if this epistle of Hebrews be not that writing, where is it? This has got to be it. Well, I might suggest to him Romans could be that, but most think that Hebrews is what Peter had in mind. Let's talk about the recipients now. Your teacher may, if you're in a different class, may argue that someone else, and let that be fine, that someone else is the author. But I'm convinced that Paul is the author of the book. Now let's talk about the recipients of the book. This is perhaps the second biggest question. You imagine here's a book, we don't know exactly who wrote it, and we're not sure who it was written to. And that's part of the puzzle of the book. On this question, the critics are much divided, Milligan suggests. There's a great division over that. But here's one thing that is agreed. It is agreed that it was written to Jewish brethren. The question is, where were they? Were they in Rome? Were they in Galatia? Were they in Palestine? Exactly where were they? Here's some various suggestions. Some suggest Italy. Some suggest Greece. Some suggest Galatia. Some suggest Spain and Egypt. And the most common thought, which I think is the case, it had to do with Jewish people who were living in Palestine. Let's give some evidence that they were in Palestine now. And this is going to help us to understand some of the things that are referenced in the book. Well, that harmonizes, first of all, with the title that was given early in the date of the book when the early manuscript said to Hebrews. That would fit with those Jewish Christians in Palestine. Whoever is addressed here were those who were familiar with the Mosaic economy, that is, with the whole Mosaic system, the system of Moses. Because you notice when he mentions, as you'll notice this when you read the book, if you've forgotten, but when the priesthood is mentioned, or Moses is mentioned, or Aaron is mentioned, or the covenant is mentioned, there is no great explanation of what all that means, as you would have to perhaps to Gentiles. Whoever he writes to, they're very familiar with the Mosaic economy. The church fathers that we've been talking about, the early writers, were not infallible, but they have a pretty good idea of a number of things, and they were generally in agreement that indeed it was the Jews in Palestine to whom it was written. What is interesting also is there is no reference to the Jew-Gentile controversy that is prevalent outside of Palestine. Romans address that. Galatians address that. But that's not addressed here in the book of Hebrews. There's some similar things. But that Jew-Gentile controversy, like you saw in Acts 15, is not addressed at all in the book of Hebrews. The church must have been made up of entirely Jews. And you say, what evidence do you have of that? Not a reference, one, or a hint of a Gentile or Gentile concerns in the epistle. There are some Gentile concerns that are addressed in the book of Romans, Galatians, but not in Hebrews. You won't find it at all. There's not a hint of a Gentile. There's not a hint of a Gentile concern. So the church to whom he is writing must have been made up of entirely of Jews. Let's go back to chapter 2. Here's a hint from chapter 2 and in verse 3 and 4. Whoever is the recipient of the letter had learned the gospel from the immediate disciples. For the word that was spoken by angels was steadfast in every transgression and disobedience received a just reward. How shall we escape if we neglect so great a salvation, which first began to be spoken by the Lord and was confirmed to us by those who heard him? Well, that would fit better with Jews in Palestine than it would Jews in Italy, wouldn't it? Italy's one of the ideas that's been prevalent, that's who it's written to, based on chapter 13. But this would seem to fit better with the Jews in Palestine. They would have heard the gospel from the original disciples. But here's something else I want you to notice from chapter 6. The danger of relapsing into Judaism would have been greater in Palestine. Now, there is a hint at that in chapter 6 and in verse 6. And it's the danger of... Let me develop this thought, because all of this is not found in chapter 6 and verse 6 and 10 and verse 29. But chapter 6 and verse 6 talks about if we fall away, there's a danger of falling away. Chapter 10 and in verse 29 talks about if they turn aside and trample underfoot the Son of God, there's a danger of reverting back. How do I know the danger is relapsing back to Judaism? Because the whole tone of the book is showing the contrast between the Jewish economy and the superior Christ. Now the point is that that concept of that danger of relapse better fits Palestine than it does anywhere else. And one more point about the author, about the recipient. There seems to be an immediate crisis from chapter 3 and in verse 13, 10 and in verse 25. So much more as you see the day approaching. That was not the second coming. And there was something about to quickly take place. Chapter 10 and in verse 37 and 12 and verse 27. There was a looming crisis. And if our understanding of the dating of the book be correct, that would have been the destruction of Jerusalem that was near at hand. So, our conclusion is that it must have reference to have written to those at Palestine. But I think we can be more specific. It seems to have reference to the church at Jerusalem. And you say, how do you know that? If that be the case, that it was written to the church at Jerusalem, it's not a general epistle. Some have put this in the category of a general epistle. This was just written to Jews everywhere and kind of scattered throughout. Well, it seems to be talking about a particular church. Let's trace some references now. And if you haven't already got your Bible open, let's start tracing some of these references. We won't notice every one because time would forbid that. So I want you to get the gist of how we draw this conclusion. Chapter 10, verse 32, beginning. This seems to apply well to Jerusalem. We've concluded, at least I have, that we're talking about Palestine at least. So this would seem to fit the church at Jerusalem, beginning at verse 32 of chapter 10. But recall the former days, after that you were illuminated, you endured a great struggle with suffering. Remember Acts 4, Acts 5, Acts 12? Remember all of that? Partly while you made a spectacle and reproaches and by tribulation, partly while you became companion of those who were so treated. Well, let's go a little bit further. Let's go to chapter 13. Verse 12 talks about the gate, outside the gate of the city. And for here have we no continuing city. Now that's an important point, and when we get to chapter 13, if it is Jerusalem, and it's before the destruction of Jerusalem, here is no continuing city. This city is not going to continue, but we're looking for one to come. Not just this city at Rome, not just this city anywhere, all of those are not going to continue, but within a period of about 5 years of the time of the writing, Jerusalem is going to be leveled flat. Now that verse makes sense to me. Well, this seems to be referring to one congregation when he says, I'm going to be restored to you. And when Timothy comes, I'm going to come with him to you. That seems to be talking about one congregation, doesn't it? They had suffered persecution, Jerusalem had, chapter 12. They're not new converts, like some that were converted later, because for the time when you ought to be teachers, remember that in chapter 5, these are not new converts. And they knew the author. According to chapter 13, verse 9, we've already talked about that. They knew Timothy, verse 23 of chapter 13. And they've had elders. Verse 7 seems to imply they have had elders. And verse 17 seems to imply that there are elders in the church. That would all seem to fit this church at Jerusalem. Arthur Pink argues from verse 24 that this seems to be a congregation of considerable size because, he mentions at verse 24, greet those who rule over you and all those who rule over you, which suggests, he implies, that that's talking about a number of elders that they may have had and a number in the church, and it may very well suggest that it was a considerable church of considerable size. King argues that the fact that there's no church that ever laid claim to the epistle is something that is easily understandable on the grounds that after the destruction of Jerusalem, no church ever existed in that location. You see, his point is that there was never a church that came along like the church at Ephesus or the church at Rome said, this was written to us. Because from the time of the writing, within a period of 5 or 6 years, there was no church in the location at Jerusalem. That makes perfect sense. Let's talk about where it was written. Very little time on this because chapter 13 in verse 24 suggests those of Italy, which would tell us probably written from Rome. Paul had been there during 2 imprisonments. And it's probably after the first that this letter is written, which brings us to the date of the book. What do we know about the dating of the book? Well, we know it was after AD 33. Evidence of that is that some of these have been Christians for some time, for when the time you ought to be teachers. And that was the earliest that anyone was a Christian, AD 33. So there's been some time. Chapter 10 also shows that some time has passed since their obedience to the gospel. Remember, we just read that a moment ago in chapter 10 and in verse 32. Recall the former days after that you were illuminated. That's been some time back. If our understanding of the date be correct, that's been at least 30 years. So some time has passed since AD 33. But we know it was before AD 70. How do we know that? Well, the temple is still standing. And I'm not going to trace every one of these references, but we'll trace some of them. But chapter 7 and in verse 8 and chapter 9, verse 6. Let's take chapter 9, verse 6, for example. That the priest always went into the first part. Now into the second part, the priest went alone. Suggesting the temple is still standing. Chapter 13 and in verse 10, another reference, which suggests the temple is still standing. It hasn't yet come. Chapter 13 and in verse 10, for we have an altar from which we serve the tabernacle, from which those who serve the tabernacle have no right to eat. Now, I know he mentions the tabernacle, but the term tabernacle included the temple quite often in the writings, and the tabernacle has been long gone, but the temple is still standing, apparently. The priests are still offering sacrifices. Chapter 8 and verse 4, their sacrifice is still being offered, which suggests the temple is still there, Jerusalem is still standing. Chapter 8, for reference quickly in verse 4, that for we here on earth, for if he were on earth, he could not be a priest. Not that the priesthood is wiped out and over, but if you were on earth, he couldn't be a priest. The priesthood is still going. And it's still there in Jerusalem. The temple is still going. So the temple is still standing. Priests are still offering sacrifices. But the destruction seems to be near. Now that's important in understanding several things about the book. Chapter 10, verse 24 and 25. You've heard this quoted many times. Let us consider one another to stir up into love and to good works. Why do we need to do that? Not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together, as the manner of some is, but exhorting one another, and so much more as you see the day approaching. The day approaching is not the second coming, because there is no evidence that you see it approaching. There was something they could see approaching. Matthew 24 said you could see the destruction of Jerusalem coming. Look at chapter 10, verse 37. I'm convinced this is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. And yet a little while, he that comes will come and will not tarry. Well, if I was talking about the second coming, and it hadn't happened yet, he did tarry. He was talking about something looming and something coming. So the destruction of Jerusalem has not yet happened, apparently. The temple is still there. Priests are still offering. The destruction, though, is near. Paul is seemingly set at liberty. Go back to chapter 13 and then verse 4. This is how we arrive at dates of books. Look at verse 23. Our brother Timothy has been set free. He has been confined somehow. With whom I shall see you if he comes. If he comes, I'm coming too. That means he's set at liberty. So that's going to put the date somewhere after 63 A.D. But before 70 A.D. So the date generally is thrown out somewhere between 63 to 66, more like 65 or 66, because it seems to be getting closer to the time of the destruction of Jerusalem. So for my studies, I'm putting 65 and 66 somewhere in that time frame. And that's going to help me to understand the looming problem that's on the scene. When I get to chapter 10, chapter 13, perhaps the persecution being so strong in chapter 12, that's going to help me in my interpretation of those verses. Now let's get to the heart of what the book is about. We've got to know a little bit about the author and the recipients and the circumstance. Let's talk about the purpose and the message of the book. What's this book all about? Let's go back to chapter 13, verse 22. You say, well, I'm not really caring about all that stuff you've been talking about. What I want is encouragement. Well, that's what the book's about. That's what it's all about. Look at chapter 13, verse 22 again. I appeal to you, brethren, bear with a word of exhortation. The point of the book was to persuade the Hebrew brethren to persevere to the end, just like they had begun, and don't give up. That's what it's all about. You say, I wished I could hear something that really helped me press on to the end. Well, hang on. We're about to embark upon the book of Hebrews, and stick with us for about 16 to 17 weeks in Bible class, and that's what you'll get. That's what the book's about. Now, here was the problem it had. There was severe persecution which created discouragement. Let's talk about the persecution. The backdrop of the book is severe persecution upon God's people. I won't bore you with a quotation from Milligan, but Milligan gives an excellent quotation that I will include at other points in some work on this. But he makes the point that when all else failed, of all of the rhetoric The last thing that the oppressor resorted to was persecution. That's all we've got left. And we'll put the pressure on. And that they did. Chapter 10, verse 32. We've already looked at it once. Look at chapter 10, verse 32 to 36. If this is not talking about persecution, the point is to press on, and based on the fact you've endured in the past, you can endure that now. Look at verse 32. Recall the former days after you were illuminated that you suffered, that you endured a great struggle and suffering. You suffered in the past. That means you can suffer now and endure now. You had compassion on me when I was in my chains. And you have having a better and enduring substance. Here's what I'm shooting for. Look at verse 36, 35. Therefore, do not cast away your confidence. Your confidence is pictured as a shield. Don't throw it down and run back like a coward. Verse 36, you have need of endurance. There's persecution they're facing. How do I know? Go to chapter 12, beginning at verse 1. He calls it the chastening of the Lord. Now, what is the chastening of the Lord? Here's your definition, verse 6. God scourges every son he receives. It is a suffering for the cause of right. And in this context, it's called a chastening of the Lord. So the context of the book deals with there was severe persecution. What had that created among the Jewish Christians? It had created great discouragement. Look at chapter 12. Therefore strengthens the hands which hang down, and feeble knees, and make paths the straight. Make straight paths for your feet, so that what is lame may not be dislocated rather than be healed. He's describing a discouraged people who are just weary, and their hands are hanging down, and their knees are getting feeble. They're discouraged because of the persecution. And so this book is written from this vantage point. It is saying, don't give up. Keep pressing on. Don't let the persecution get to you. You face that persecution, and you face it with courage. And here's how you're going to do that. Recognizing the superiority of Christ. Chapter 1, verse 4 is the key to the book. Chapter 13, verse 22, it is a word of exhortation. That's what the book is about. But it's based on this argument, chapter 1 and verse 4, that Christ, notice these three words you might underline, so much better. Christ is so much better. So much better than what? Here's this flow of argument. Christ is so much better than the prophets. These were things the Jews, the Hebrews, esteemed so highly. And the pressure to come back into Judaism was, go back to where the prophets stood, go back with Moses, and go back with Aaron, and go back to the priesthood. Oh no, don't do that, because Christ is so much better than the prophets. Chapter 1, 1 to 3. Christ is so much better than the angels. Chapter 1, 4, 2 to 18. So much better than Moses, chapter 3. So much better than Joshua, chapter 4. So much better than Aaron, chapters 5 through 7. Now, those are great characters or principles found in the Old Testament. Christ is better than prophets, angels, Moses, Joshua, and Aaron. But furthermore, he offers a better rest than the Canaan rest. He has a better priesthood, chapters 4, 5, and 7 and 8. He has a better sacrifice, 7 and 8, and a better covenant, chapters 8 and 9. Christ is so much better. If you've missed chapter 1 and verse 4, you might mark that, underline that in your Bible. Here's the key to what the book is about. Christ is so much better. There are five warning sections in the book that are based upon doctrine. I want you to watch for those as we study the book. And as we work through the book, I may reword this and change this a little bit, but the warning sections are still there, but I may change my title of that. This chart is not original with me. I borrowed that from a seminary somewhere that I found, where it presents the book as dealing with a doctrinal section, chapter 1, 1 to 4, that is then followed by a warning. The warning there is neglect of duty. Then he turns around and gives another doctrinal section, followed by another warning, chapter 3 through chapter 4 and verse 16, which warns against the hardening of the heart. Then there's another doctrinal section that is followed by a warning after that. This sounds a lot like Paul did to me. And the warning there is about not growing and not maturing. Here's another doctrinal section, and that's followed by this warning of not drawing back into sin. Another doctrinal section followed by a warning against refusing to accept the teaching. Now, I may reword some of that as we go a little further, but for now, that gives us the idea that here's a doctrinal section, and then he comes back and warns. He gives a doctrinal section, then comes back and warns, and then a doctrinal section, and comes back and warns. And the argument that some have made is, this couldn't be Paul because there is not a doctrinal practical distinction, like he typically does. Well, that does sound like Paul to me. It's exactly like he did in Galatians and in Romans and other texts. Now, does this book help us at all? The warnings of the book well adapt to us. King observed that the epistle was written to second generation Christians to whom the new religion had lost its freshness and wonder. You take a Jew that had been converted from Judaism into Christianity, and when the pressure was on, the freshness of that new religion has lost all of its luster and they're discouraged. Does that ever happen to you? When you obeyed the gospel, you were excited about being a Christian, and it had all the luster of a new relationship, and you're discouraged now because it's kind of gotten dull and it's lost its luster. This book was written to those kind of people. Milligan observed that in hints it follows that while the world stands, the epistle will be to the church an anchor of the soul, both sure and steadfast. No other portion of the written word could better be calculated to encourage all Christians to persevere in the divine life to the perfected holiness and the fear of God. There's not another book around that will do the better job of encouraging you to press on to the end than this book. Well, let's talk a little bit about the Old Testament. In the book of Hebrews. If you're unfamiliar with the Old Testament, this book will be frustrating, and that's one reason people don't like the book. You delve into the book of Acts, for example, and you can get most of that, and it's a pretty good flow of the book without having a great knowledge of the Old Testament. But one of the frustrating things, and people get discouraged about the book, is they're just, I don't know of a better way to say it, they're just ignorant of the Old Testament. And our ignorance of the Old Testament frustrates us when we get to the book of Hebrews because we don't know what it's talking about. And we're unfamiliar with that psalm, and we're unfamiliar with that quotation and that reference and the tabernacle and how it operated and the difference between the priest and the high priest. This book quotes from the Old Testament very heavily. In fact, 35 times as compared to some 93 total times in the writings of Paul. It accounts for one-tenth of the quotations in the New Testament from the Old Testament. Now, you think of 27 books of the New Testament, and a tenth of all the Old Testament references are found in this book. That's a heavy dose of Old Testament. The Psalm is the Psalms are the most quoted, with the Pentateuch running a close second to that. What's also unique about this book is generally, rather than just a phrase quoted or a verse quoted, there's longer quotations. An example of that is in Hebrews 8. Wherein Jeremiah 31, 31 to 34, that whole section is quoted and developed and then comment made upon it by the Apostle Paul, if he be the author. Now, the real value of studying the book of Hebrews in light of the Old Testament is the type of the greater to come. For example, I understand better what the Old Testament was about when I come to the book of Hebrews. Because the tabernacle and the priesthood was a shadow of the real, according to chapter 8 in verse 5. The law was a shadow of a greater law to come, chapter 10 in verse 1. Melchizedek was a type of Christ. But if I didn't have the New Testament, I wouldn't understand what Melchizedek is doing back here and what the point of him is, or the tabernacle, or the priesthood. But the book of Hebrews helps me to understand something that no other book does. No other book talks about the type and the antitype and the types and the shadows, as does the book of Hebrews. So we have to get familiar with the Old Testament to appreciate the book. It also serves to prove inspiration. And you say, how so? Quite often in Paul's writings, he would talk about the Scripture says, as thus saith the Scripture. But in the book of Hebrews, like in chapter 1, he quotes from the Old Testament, several Old Testament references, and he will say, he says. Which tells me that the writer of the book of Hebrews thought that when Psalms was being written, Deuteronomy and Samuel and other references were written, that it was the writing of God. It's an affirmation of inspiration. We see that again in Hebrews chapter 10, 6 to 8. He quotes from the Old Testament and he said, he says. Changes a little bit in chapter 3 and verse 7. He says, the Holy Spirit says, when he quotes from the Old Testament. One of the things we'll be watching for is those Old Testament references and the use that is made of that. Let's talk about the style of the book, and then we'll talk about the outline of the book, and then we'll be done. What's the style of the book? Well, it is a high form of writing. We don't notice this in reading the English. You read the book of Romans, and then you read the book of Galatians, 1 Corinthians, 2 Corinthians, and Ephesians, and then you come over and read Hebrews, and you say, okay, I don't see a lot of difference. Maybe. But if you could read Greek and you understood that, which I can't read the Greek, but if we could, we would see a high form of writing. Again, let me quote from the King. He says that from a literary perspective, the book of Hebrews is the most carefully developed writing in the New Testament. As far as style is concerned, it also demonstrates the best Greek in any New Testament writing. If you could find a non-Christian somewhere who was a Greek scholar who could appreciate well-written Greek and let him read all through the New Testament, which one stands out as the best written and the highest form of language? He would say the book of Hebrews, without a doubt. It stands at the pinnacle of all of those. But I'm more interested in this. It's presented much like a sermon. And some have argued this is not a letter. Some don't even like to call the book an epistle. Because they say this is actually a sermon. This is basically sermon notes is what this is. And they base it on chapter 13 and in verse 22, a word of exhortation. And that same kind of terminology was used by Paul about a sermon that he preached. Acts 13 and verse 15. But I like what Lightfoot said because he gets the whole concept. He said, here's a book that begins like a treatise, proceeds like a sermon, and ends like a letter. You start off and it sounds like a treatise, and that he is setting out to prove a proposition. Christ, who is so much better than prophets, he's so much better than angels, he's so much better than Moses. And before he gets through, you say, well, he sounds like he's preaching now. I mean, he's cutting down and preaching now. And then when he gets through toward the end of the book, it sounds like a personal letter he's writing, that I hope to come and see you. Timothy's been released. They of Italy greet you. Lightfoot is correct. It begins like a treatise, proceeds like a sermon, and ends like a letter. Now let's close with talking about an outline. Outlines are important from this vantage point. There is no agreement, though, among students as to the structure. And I say that because this is a very difficult book to outline. And don't get excited if you're sitting in a class and the teacher's outline differs from what I'm going to present here, because outline is based upon interpretation of the book. And it requires interpretation. If you decide to put these verses together, that's because you've interpreted that's what that's saying. And that's part of it. Dr. J. Brown suggests that there are two major sections to the book. He didn't give titles to them, but the book divides at chapter 10 and verse 18. And others have ridiculed that, said that can't be, that we just don't have two major divisions of the book. But just a cursory reading, it seems that there is a change at chapter 10 and verse 18. And this is how I view the book. Two major thoughts. Chapters 1 through, in verse 1, through chapter 10 and verse 18, is all about arguing Christ is the way. He's better than prophets, better than angels, etc. We'll get to that in just a second. Christ is the way. Chapter 10, verse 19 to the end of the book is, don't give up. Here's the basis. Here's what you do about it. Christ is the way. Don't give up. Christ is better. Keep pressing on. Now, this section is not totally doctrinal. There's some practical exhortation given in the first 10 chapters. This is not all exhortational. There's some doctrine taught there. But that doesn't keep this from being generally an exhortation, and the first being the doctrine on which it's based. Christ is so much better. Let's look at the first section. There are two sections to that. That is, he talks about the superiority of Christ's person and the superiority of Christ's work. What about his person? We talk about the superiority over prophets in chapter 1, verses 1 to 3. The superiority over angels from chapter 1 and verse 4 to chapter 2 and verse 18. The superiority over Moses. That carries us to the 13th verse of chapter 14. So that's the superiority of Christ's person. He is so much better, chapter 1, verse 4. But let's also talk about his work being superior. There's the superiority of his priesthood, chapters 4 through 7. The superiority of Christ's covenant, his law, chapter 8. The superiority of his sanctuary, chapter 9. And the superiority of his sacrifice, chapters 9 and 10. So since the person of Christ is superior and his work is superior, Christ is the way. Don't turn away from him. That leads us to the second half of the book. So his point here in chapter 10, 19 to 13, 28 is keeping the faith. Don't give up. That's all of chapter 10, just about. Chapter 10, 19 to the end of the chapter. Well, chapter 11, we call Faith Hall of Fame, examples of faith. So keeping the faith, here are examples of faith. Chapter 12, the endurance of faith. And chapter 13, the performance of faith. Here's what faith will do. So the book ought to make sense to us. That Christ is the way, don't give up. That's what I need. That's what you need. You need to be a part of the study. Here's some things to look for, and we're through it. I'm not going to go through this whole list, but you might want to make a note of some things you want to watch for as you study the book of Hebrews. Watch for that word better. Something is better than something else. Scattered throughout the book from chapter 1, chapter 6 and 7 and 8 and 9 and 10 and 11 and 12. Christ is so much better. Something is better. A better priesthood, a better covenant. He's better in His person. Look for the emphasis of great. Something is great. Great salvation that we have. Watch for the term priesthood, for the term heavenly. And look what we have and what we've gained. We have a high priest that has passed into the heavens, chapter 4 and verse 14. It'll be a fascinating book. And we don't have time to do what we just did here in the Bible class and cover chapter 1 next week. And so that's an introduction of the book of Hebrews. Hopefully that's whetted your appetite to say, I want to study that book. It may have some depth to it, and it may be intimidating a little bit, but I want to study that book. I want to learn where I can be encouraged from that book. I want to see Christ is the way. And then I want to be exhorted to not give up based on that. We all need that. There may be one or more present who's not a Christian, who's not a child of God. Would you come believing that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God? Would you repent of your sins, acknowledge your faith, and be buried in the waters of baptism for the remission of sins? If you're subject in any way, would you come while together we stand and sing?